The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, it seems that every time a sort of criminal act that's called a financial necessity occurs, Goldman Sachs seems to be in the mix. Now, I thought that was just here in the United States, but we're starting to hear things about Greece and Goldman Sachs.
Kevin, when you go to the morgue, you're asking the question, how did we get here? You know, what happened? And that's basically what we have in Europe. As we go to the European morgue, how did we get here? Why do we have the problems that we have with Greece, with Spain, with Portugal, with Italy, with Ireland? Kevin, it's interesting. You suggested, and it is accurate, Goldman was a part of it. Going back to 2001, Goldman created a number of currency swaps, 13 to be precise. And, you know, these were off-market derivative contracts, and they were swapping yen into euros.
Okay, but why? I mean, what is it a currency swap would have done in 2001 that would have aided Greece in some way?
These were specifically done with the Greek government, and they were to conceal the true size of the nation's debt. And, Kevin, this comes from the European Union Statistics Office, reported by Bloomberg. But the point is, Kevin, you've got an organization which is purposefully creating fraudulent data and perception in the marketplace so that Greece can be welcomed into the euro. Greece can be viewed as a standout citizen, future contributor to the European Union, and with a pristine balance sheet. Kevin, this is one of the things that cost Arthur Andersen their very survival.
Sure. It's deceptive accounting. I mean, it's purposeful deceptive accounting because Greece had to have a certain look before they were entered into the European Union.
What's particularly interesting, Kevin, is the ECB fears this information being discussed openly.
Right.
They've moved to block disclosure. In fact, there's a court case right now being heard in front of the EU's General Court, and the ECB is trying to get it dismissed. And this lawsuit is seeking to disclose the actual use of these derivatives set up by Goldman with the Greek government in order to hide the real financial condition of the Greek government at the time.
Okay, Dave, it's easy for us to sit over here in the United States and look over at Europe and go, oh, boy, those guys are absolutely messed up. But, you know, he who is without sin needs to cast the first stone. This sounds to me like what our government has done with the FASB rules. They don't really want true accounting to show up because, boy, it's an ugly picture.
It's true, Kevin. There's a lot of similarities between the way we account for things or one them viewed by our foreign creditors. So, you know, truly, there's no one that is lily white here, Kevin. With today's conversation, we're going to talk a little bit about Greece and Portugal and the euro. We've got some ground to cover in talking about the dollar, gold and silver, and the correction that they're in presently. Kevin, some dynamics with the Dow and the S&P, a strong look at U.S. consumer inflation. Of course, it's on everyone's mind what's happening with the debt ceiling and how that will be resolved and what the implications are.
Well, it doesn't sound like there is a ceiling, David. It feels like that ceiling just keeps getting raised and raised as, oh, I don't know, government retirement funds get lower and lower. But I'd like to hear from you on that because I wonder how they feel.
Well, back to Greece and Portugal. In particular, the $78 billion euro bailout is moving forward for Portugal. And what's unprecedented, Kevin, is this. They're requesting or requiring that private bondholders keep what they own. In other words, no liquidations are allowed. And it's the first time that this sort of voluntary pledge has been requested from private creditors. So is it a requirement? Not necessarily, but it certainly is a strong request.
They'll strongly frown upon anyone who wants to cash in their absolutely fine and perfectly liquid bond. They just can't cash it in.
Right. So it's being put out there as almost a condition for this guarantee of 78 billion euros, Kevin, for Portugal. And at the same time, we've got Greece, which is in what they would call a soft restructuring as we speak. This morning, they're looking at extending the maturities of their loans or of their current debt. Kevin, that's not unlike you and I here in the United States. If we took a 30-year mortgage and turned it into a 50-year mortgage, our monthly payments would go down. Now, we still have the same debt to pay, and we have actually more in interest payments.
It's like turning chickpeas to hummus, Dave. I mean, it's a Greek thing you do anyway, isn't it?
Well, extending maturity, certainly, and it's not the first time that there's been a restructuring of Greek debt. But in Europe, I think you'd have to go back to 1948 to see a major restructuring. So, you know, they're not calling it a restructuring. It's actually a soft restructuring because it's just an extension of maturities. call it what you will, it's the first stage of the inevitable, which is a restructuring and a form of default.
Well, it's unpayable. It's like a lot of the debt that we've talked about. It's unpayable. It's just how do we extend this to make it go a little bit longer? Now, if the complicit deception was revealed, what are some of the names that would probably surface to the top, you know, just like cream, surface right to the top? There are some names right now that are nervous that there would be accurate reporting in Europe.
Well, and I'm sure that those are the people who've been calling the ECB and calling in favors.
Uh-huh.
If I were Lloyd Blankfein, I would be a little bit upset right now. If I were Hank Paulson, you know, I actually had tenure at CEO as Hank Paulson. Not that I am, but just
in case.
You know, good old Henry was head of Goldman Sachs, also during a period in time where those kinds of currency swaps were being orchestrated.
They sure are clever. I mean, they are good with numbers.
But see, they're not an accounting firm, so they can't be held responsible for the deals they put together. They are a deal-making firm. That's sure. What they do for a living, is put together deals. So why should they be judged for doing what they're supposed to do? It is their MO in the marketplace. Kevin, I think this is where we begin to see a breakdown in trust. We've already seen it with individual institutions, but where authorities who are hiding things get caught hiding things. The ECB is betting a lot and sticking out its neck in trying to protect this information. They realize that there's unintended consequences. There are huge consequences to knowing what those deals consisted of. Kevin, I think we'd blush if we knew the back alley deals which were done between the Fed and different financial institutions, between the financial institutions and overseas central banks. Kevin, it's just one of those things where as we work through this cycle, as we talked with Neil Howe last week, and we get through what he considers the fourth turning, we will get full disclosure, and it's not going to be pretty. And my hope is that we don't end up with a Robespierre and a guillotine. But there's going to be a lot of anger and frustration by this inside dealing.
Well, not just in Europe. You know, the spotlight seems to be focused there just temporarily right now. They're still going through their trouble. We've talked over and over about the problems with the dollar. Now, the dollar during this period of time, even though both currencies are fiat currencies and they're falling, the dollar seems to be rising, and that's affecting the gold market, the silver market. We seem to be in a correction right now. We've seen corrections in the past in the bull market back in the 1970s, but there was a point when we didn't see corrections. Can you take us through that a little bit?
I hate to sound like a parrot, Kevin, but it was last year this time that we were talking about the seasonal correction of gold, usually a strong finish into the spring, and then when you go into the summer months, just kind of the lackadaisical, traders are taking vacations. For lots of different reasons, you have a seasonal correction in the metals. This year, we got an extra boost with the CME changing margin requirements. We've talked about that in recent weeks.
Right.
It's the seasonal corrections, Kevin, that you can begin to anticipate and as a trader, as an investor, take advantage of. My one concern is this. As you move further into a bull market, those seasonal corrections don't appear. And I'm thinking of 1974, 1975, 1976, 1977.
Well, David, we're getting into family history now, because the origins of your father's and mother's starting of this firm basically were the 70s. And that was remembered as the last great bull market in gold until this one. And there are a lot of patterns to learn from. Fortunately, you were raised in that period.
Yeah, and it was those years, Kevin, up until 1977, where you could expect seasonality.
Right.
Soft patch in the summer months, very expected, very predictable. You'd take in your two steps forward and one step back. Gold had been in a bull market for many years and had gone from $35 to over $165.
Yeah.
And then as we moved into 1978 and 1979, if you were expecting the correction to come, it wasn't there. It didn't materialize. 1979, it wasn't there. It didn't materialize. When you get, whatever the bull market is, whether it's real estate, whether it is technology stocks, whether it's gold and silver in this particular case, when you get to the final phase of a bull market, seasonality goes out the window, and technical traders who consider themselves geniuses up to that point get left out and are on the sidelines for the big moves.
David, for the last 30 years, we've talked to two types of people who remember those years, okay, if they were adults. There are those who said, gosh, I was so close to buying. Okay, but it just kept moving up.
I could have bought it lower.
Oh,
the
yeah.
price was moving up, and I thought, well, surely it's going to correct. It'll give me an opportunity.
It was coulda, shoulda, woulda. But there was also the guy, okay, who finally said, oh, this thing's just going to go up forever. And at $850, he bought gold. and really didn't see 850 until just a couple of years ago.
Right, and I think some of the important work we do on the program here, Kevin, because we're trying to identify trends as well as transitions.
Right.
And the trends remain in place for the metals. The transition points we have not yet seen, but we are looking at them and looking for them feverishly every day. Kevin, as we move further into this bull market, I'm getting less and less sleep because I'm concerned, because these are dynamics which are quickly becoming third stage bull market dynamics. I think the last move in silver up to $50 from $17.50 to $50 was a foreshadowing of what we'll see in the gold market, and ultimately what we'll see in silver taking it to much higher prices, $50 being left behind in the dust. But Kevin, this is a transition, an intellectual and an emotional transition point for clients as they look ahead and realize that the market dynamics are changing utterly. If they're assuming that the markets are going to remain rational, if they're assuming they're going to remain predictable with sort of a two steps forward, one step back, they are sorely mistaken.
But at this point, we do have a luxury that we may not have down the road. We have a luxury that we are in, or wouldn't you say, we're in a correction right now.
I think the probabilities favor this being the last seasonal correction in this particular bull market, where in next year and the year after, as we move to 2012, 13, and 14, things begin to move at a pace where it simply blows your hair back. And I think, Kevin, what we see now off of a peak of 1577 on the gold price is roughly a 10% correction. That would take us to roughly 1420. Mm-hmm. And I think that is where we see an excellent entry point. Between 1450 and 1420, if you're not aggressively buying, I think this is going to be your low point for the year. You've got the 200-day moving average, which is a little bit lower, 1365, and it's moving higher.
Right.
It's moving higher every day. So we have, Kevin, a number of technical supports which are actually rising to meet the current price of both gold and silver, and I think make a compelling case for entering the metals over the next 2 to 3 to 4 weeks.
So you're basically saying we're 5 to 10% away from a bottom that we may not see for the rest of this bull market.
No, I think 5% on gold, probably 10% on silver. We're sitting around 33 and change today, Kevin, on the silver price, and I would be aggressively buying between 35 and 31. Why not just pick 31 and say, hey, it's a better number, it's a better entry point? Because there's enough clustered reasons at that price for every trader and their brother to be entering the market at the same time, and you'd have to be so fast on the trigger by the time we get to $30, $31 an ounce, that I don't think many investors will actually take advantage of that pricing.
So what you're saying, it's actually a good idea to buy maybe a little early or sell a little early in the quiet than when it's just a roaring crowd.
What you just suggested, Kevin, is utterly, utterly important for clients to remember. It's not just on the purchase side, but on the liquidation side, you always sell too soon. You always sell too soon. And if you leave something on the table, if you could have made more money, you really don't know what you're doing as an investor. That's the only way you make money as an investor, is leaving something on the table. Because when the masses try to move to the exits at once, the odds of you moving out of any market, whether it's real estate, look at real estate today.
Right.
There was a time when you could sell your house in roughly weeks. We sold our house. It was a for sale by owner. We sold our house in Southern California in a matter of weeks when we left California.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kevin, if you had the greatest representation in the market, someone with 25 years of marketing and sales experience in real estate, you couldn't move your Southern California home in 3 months, 6 months, maybe even a year or two. We're talking about a change in the dynamics of the market where you have liquidity up until a point, and when the market turns, liquidity goes away unless it's at an extremely discounted price. That's not where we're at today, Kevin, but as you suggest, as you look ahead and say, okay, higher prices in this particular bull market, sell too soon. The old adage from Meyer Amschel Rothschild of buy when there's blood in the streets and sell too soon is something that I think clients can keep in mind.
Well, Dave, this brings up a good point, because we're all hopeful people. Here as Americans, we want to have hope. And so the market name for a hopeful market is a bull market. Okay. The market name for a market in despair or a dropping market is a bear market. Now, the bulls, especially, they love to run in a crowd. Okay. But you have to be a solitary-minded person, whether you're a bull or a bear, to get in or out at the right time. So, David, in a nutshell, what you're saying is this may be the opportunity, the last real correction on these markets before we start seeing just pure up moves.
On its way to $2,000 gold and $100 silver, yeah, I think so.
Something that I know you watch that a lot of investors don't is the volatility indexes. Is the volatility index telling us anything right now about the stock market, the paper markets?
Well, I know we mentioned this a couple weeks ago, Kevin, but the VIX was at about 14.5, and it's currently at about 18.5. So you've seen a 27% move in 2 weeks in the volatility index.
So what you're saying is more volatility, and that's usually a shaking before a breaking.
Yeah, essentially, when the volatility index gets down to 10 or 15, you're just begging for a correction in the stock market, because what it tells you is that everyone's already loaded to one side of the boat, and it's the bullish side of the boat. Everyone's assuming that it's all blue sky from here, and it's only happy days that'll be here from now into the foreseeable future. What you generally see at that point is an inflection, and this coincides, Kevin, with the end of the positive 6 months of stock investing. You know, they say sell in May and go away. Why is that? Why is that an old Wall Street adage, sell in May and go away?
Is there a seasonality to the pattern?
There is, and basically the good 6 months of the stock market end in May, and the worst 6 months just began.
Oh, remember October every year. Remember October. Almost every year, it's a bad month.
Well, so we're in the negative seasonal period. You've got the VIX, which tapped a low at 14.5, and there's nothing really compelling there in terms of value. Would you suggest, or would we suggest, a correction in the stock market? I think you're slotted for one.
Well, how about emerging markets then? I mean, that's something that people watch because they're so darned exciting.
Well, you know, Kevin, this is sort of a balance sheet issue. As you look at the U.S. balance sheet, as you look at the European balance sheet, everything is being skewed towards healthier balance sheets elsewhere. It's not that you have less risk or less volatility in the emerging markets. In fact, you have more risk and more volatility in the emerging markets. But you've got a lot of companies who are generating tons of revenues overseas and have relatively healthy balance sheets. Now, I think that's pretty much been priced into those shares. So even if you could make a case for investing in the emerging markets as opposed to the developed market world today, Kevin, I think you're talking about rich premiums, and that's not where you make money. You make money buying at discounts and selling at premiums, not buying at premiums and selling at even higher premiums. That momentum kind of trade is what gets people in trouble. And I would suggest that whether it is the developed market or the emerging markets, you've got plenty of risk that you're taking and putting into your portfolio if you're out buying equities here or yon.
So really, in the stock market or any financial market where you're trying to make money, you don't want to buy something that's accurately priced. You want to buy something that's underpriced. And what you're saying is, even if they're not overpriced right now, they're full. They're full of accuracy.
Kevin, I think the best work that's being done right now is contrasting the developing world with the emerging world, and the developed markets with the emerging markets. And it's by contrast that they're saying, clearly, this makes much more sense going to the emerging markets. If you look at the growth rates, if you look at GDP growth rates, they're off the charts. And I guess what I would remind people of is that with any investment, you want to know what your real rate of return is.
Right.
So while you may not be tied to an overseas tax regime, you are tied to the overseas inflation rate. And so if you're seeing and if you're buying a particular company, if you're looking with interest at an overseas market, and you're looking at a growth thematic that you think is compelling because there's a 10% year-on-year growth rate, remember what the inflation rate is as well and subtract that out of the growth rate before you get too excited. You know, currently the inflation rate in China is reported to be 5.4% with a growth rate still almost double digit. The problem is they've fudged the numbers just like the Bureau of Labor Statistics has fudged the numbers on inflation. And a more realistic view of inflation in China is somewhere between 10% if you're conservative, and I would suggest closer to 15%, putting your annual growth rate at either flat to negative, not positive double digit. And again, this is where an investor has to back away from the emotion of investing in a headline number, something that's very attractive, a double digit growth rate. I mean, China's got to be remaking the world. This has got to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. I went in. Slow down. Ask yourself the question, what's the real rate of return here?
That's exactly right, David. If you lose the value of the buying power of the currency that you're in, you're not gaining, you're actually still losing. Now, here in America, let's bring this back close to home, because people right now in the bank are excited if they get 3% on a CD, maybe 4%, they're pushing it into maybe the more risky bank accounts. The rate of inflation right now is being reported at about 3.2%. How does that actually play out in real rate of return?
Sure. And before we go there, Kevin, just, you know, in fairness, this isn't to pick on China. You could say the same is true of Brazil and India with rampant inflation in those countries. Mm-hmm. The recent correction in gold and silver, and you've got bullion dealers in Mumbai and Chennai who can't keep their shelves stocked with even the most basic bullion items in either gold or silver. Not just jewelry, but investment demand products where you're talking about bars and coins. Kevin, there's a real-world inflation happening globally, and if the price gives at all, those who are most aware of the inflation and sensitive to it buy with both fists.
And those people are not speculating on price moves. These people are just trying to hedge themselves against the buying power of their currency being destroyed.
Right. Kevin, essentially, it's the masses trying to take the other side of the bet. If government is going to destroy currencies, then they have to take out an insurance policy on their savings. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Kevin, you mentioned, you know, our current rate. April's numbers put our inflation rate annually at 3.2%. This is where, again, we find a shift, Kevin, in Congress has ordered the Bureau of Labor Statistics, pressured them over the years to change their methodology, the way in which they measure inflation. This is not just a group of academics at the Bureau of Labor Statistics saying we found a more efficient way to do this.
They're being pressured. There's a reason, too, for that, David. What's the reason?
Congress made the call in 1980. Congress made the call in 1990. This methodology has changed. So while we look at an official rate of 3.2%, if you go back to the official methodology used in 1990 by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, our rate of inflation today would not be judged at 3.2%. It would be 6.5%.
6.5. Now, that was using 1990 methodology, but that had already been changed from earlier.
Well, you're right. It gets better. The 1980 methodology would put our today's inflation rate at the official Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation rate at 10.7%. So are we looking at 3% as a real-world inflation rate?
6%.
6% or 10%.
Right.
And it boils down to how you want to and how you choose to measure the number. This is the interesting thing, Kevin, because Volcker, by this appraisal, Volcker was fighting the boogeyman.
Right, because there wasn't inflation. If we used today's numbers, we might have even had deflation when Volcker was out there.
His efforts were a farce.
Yeah.
I mean, in retrospect, there was no inflation in the 1970s. We need to go back and tell that generation that what they were experiencing was a mirage.
Well,
it simply didn't exist.
It reminds me of today. They're telling us, as long as you don't eat food and you don't put gas in your car, we really don't have inflation.
That's right. On a steady diet of iPads. But that's the issue, Kevin. Either the methodology was right then or it's right now. Either there was no inflation then and there was a boogeyman, or the numbers that we're talking about today, 3.2%, that's the mirage. That's the fiction. That's the farce. And we have a whole investment community that is assuming we have exactly what Ben Bernanke just 2 weeks ago said we had.
Yeah, they have financial TV that can show them that not only is it transitory, but they can be a bull for another day.
Right. So inflation, Kevin, in my opinion, will inflame a popular revolt. In no small part, Kevin, because people will determine that their government has intentionally lied to them and for decades has gotten to cover up their balance sheet insolvency, creatively producing a GDP figure which wasn't real.
Right.
Because, and we've said this many times before on the program, Kevin, but if you understate inflation, the other side of the equation is you're overstating GDP.
Right.
And so again, whether it's an emerging market problem or a developed market problem, we have central bankers the world over, we have statisticians the world over who know how to grind the numbers through the machine to come up with a number that is sellable.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. So, David, it really is a credibility issue. I mean, when the crowd actually starts to see that prices are rising beyond what they can keep up with, there could be a major revolt.
When you don't trust your government, you don't trust their numerous representations and promises, including the dollar system, including the system of government debt obligations, and the idea that long-term promises or liabilities will be paid out. Kevin, you're talking about a breakdown politically.
Right.
Or if you're not talking about a breakdown politically, an actual political revolt, you're talking about a revolt from the currency itself, and that's the dynamic that you end up with superinflation or hyperinflation. It's actually not the Fed printing more and more. It's the Fed printing more and more until a threshold has been reached, and that threshold is one of confidence and credibility. When confidence fails, when credibility is lost, then you have a revolt of the masses out of a currency. They simply went out. They simply want out at any price, and they're willing to buy anything at any price because they don't want to hold the worthless script in their hands. So that's where credibility becomes an issue, Kevin. This is a generational crisis in that we have a fully entitled public who's looking to those long-term debt obligations, those long-term promises. And Kevin, we've got the majority of our population now on the dole in some form or another.
Over 51%.
Kevin, let's assume that it's 100 million people across the country who are going to be dealing with the greater likelihood of broken promises.
Right. Well, and you know, we've talked about the entitlement mentality before, and it's easy to point a finger and say, these people are taking money from us, so they can't be supported. But actually, I was just talking to someone the other day, and we were talking about entitlement. And this was a sweet lady who's retired, who doesn't want to see her retirement cut in the form of Social Security. Well, these are not bad people, all of them across the nation that are in entitlement types of programs. They're people who built their entire structure of their retirement plan based on the government paying out when the time came.
Yeah, the social safety net meant that they could spend more and save less because they knew their retirement was going to be supplemented by Social Security. So this was the promise, this was the social contract. And it's the contract that may be broken, Kevin. We've got the debt ceiling, which is certainly in our listeners' minds. Use of federal retirement funds, that is what is being used today to supplement debt financing.
That's got to be a concern. When you're a federal worker, you're working for that retirement most often.
And I guess, Kevin, what Geithner has chosen is to keep the gears of government churning by actually borrowing from federal workers' retirement funds. I find this fascinating because it's the first time since this crisis began that you get a true picture of the snake eating itself, the snake eating its tail, Kevin. And it almost makes me smile thinking that now the public sector gets to worry about the solvency of the U.S. government as they watch their retirements, even in small amounts, get spent just to keep the game going. Now they know what it's like for the rest of us.
Well, yeah, David, actually, they've got skin in the game this time. And, you know, in the past, you're right. The federal workers have seen the markets go up, the markets go down. They've heard this, they've heard that. But in reality, it hasn't affected their retirements. It hasn't reflected on their salaries. Public workers' salaries have gone up while private sectors have gone down.
It's going to be interesting, Kevin, to see how long the federal employees stand for their retirement funds being used to fund the functions of government. They'll pressure for a higher debt ceiling. Kevin, the reality is the debt ceiling's a farce to begin with.
Right.
We absorbed Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. We have off-balance sheet liabilities. So 14.3 doesn't even matter. We're already at 20.7. This is gamesmanship, Kevin. This is brinksmanship. The Republicans get to show that they're fiscally responsible by saying we need to cut the budget. Kevin, the Republicans never made a dollar that they didn't spend $1.50 on. The reality is they're no more fiscally responsible than the Democrats, but this does give them an inflection point coming into the next election to say, see, it's not our fault. We asked for responsible government. We asked for smaller government. We asked for responsible spending, and it's the Democrats' fault, therefore put us in office.
So, David, the irresponsible behavior, it continues, whether it's Republican, Democrat, maybe even Libertarian, as we're starting to see that movement. There's been a warning, however, if that irresponsible behavior continues, there's going to be another financial crisis.
Yeah, well, Stanley Druckenmiller, probably an unfamiliar name to some, but he was a partner with George Soros at the Quantum Fund, who helped break the Bank of England and break the pound sterling. He was actually pulling the strings and making those trades happen as the main trader with the Quantum Fund. But he was recently reflecting and shared these ideas with the Wall Street Journal. A financial crisis is surely going to happen as bigger than the one we had in 2008 if we continue to behave the way we are behaving. And then the Wall Street Journal went on to say that solving the real problem was Washington's spending addiction. The results would, in Druckenmiller's opinion, be catastrophic if we didn't address that behavior.
Well, I wonder if he's going to bet against the dollar like he bet against the pound. I mean, I think they made a cool $2 billion, he and Soros, when they did that, didn't they?
Well, I tell you what, if he's not betting against the dollar, somebody will be, and they've got good reason to be.
Well, David, you know, we keep thinking that this is we're told it was a republic, and we're now told it's a democracy. But if it were really populists that were being asked about raising the debt ceiling, 47% of the people, they're not even for it, and actually, it's a minority way, way down the list that actually would like to see the debt ceiling raised.
You're right. In recent polls, 47% of Americans responded that they did not want to see the debt ceiling raised. 19% thought that it was okay, and I'm guessing that the remainder probably don't know what you're talking about, but would likely take to the streets if their monthly check didn't come in. The dark side of democracy, Kevin, is now a present tense reality. The majority have nothing to lose. The majority have nothing to lose and everything to gain by voting for government largesse. I mean, as a society, you mentioned it a few minutes ago, 51% are receiving some form of funds from the federal government.
And they don't want to see that stop, no matter how painful we have to make it for everyone else.
47% of the population pay no taxes, yet we have universal suffrage. This is a strange reality, Kevin. You don't pay, but you can play.
Yeah, so you get to vote, even if you're not paying taxes. It seems wrong, and I'm sure there's quite a bit of a debate that we could come into, you know, as to whether that's right or wrong.
But to remove ourselves from the current discussion and say, okay, Alexander Tyler saw this decades ago, more than decades ago. Have you heard of voting yourself the treasury? That's the last chapter of a democracy. When politicians determine that they can distribute funds in such a way to buy themselves votes, and people get addicted to that money, Kevin, that's the end of a democracy. And in Tyler's opinion, that's what leads to a totalitarian regime.
Well, and I guess the way you keep the crowds from getting too upset right away is you continue to feed them, I guess, bread and circuses. And you really have to control the flow of information, don't you? I mean, you have to control the press to some degree.
That was a concept that Harold James talked about in a recent article, historian and professor at Princeton.
And a guest of ours.
Right. Well, in his article, Machiavellian Economics, a great title, he says that in the past, Europeans avoided or controlled crises by controlling the press and controlling the information that people had. How much did they know? What did they have to respond or react to? And he illustrates using Mussolini's fascist government, who controlled the press. And during past crises, the Italian banks, although equally insolvent to their counterparts in Germany and Austria, fared quite well. James says that deception might be a source of comfort. We might find ourselves, in fact, warm and contented in a cocoon of untruth.
You know, that really rings true. If you think about society right now, in a way, we're all warm and contented in a cocoon of untruth. Even in the Greek situation over in Europe, they don't want to see the truth because once the truth comes out, it's not comfortable. You're no longer contented.
How about the FASB rules and marking to market bad debts on U.S. bank balance sheets?
Right.
I mean, we want a free pass. We do want greater financial stability. But transparency, well, I guess we could use, but it would come at a price, wouldn't it?
Well, David, it makes me think you can be warm and content for only so long with untruth. And then when you start seeing the truth, Hitler took his lesson from Mussolini, but he took it a step further, didn't he?
Yeah, he said that the ultimate cause for Reichmark stability and in their currency stability under his rule was the concentration camp.
So I guess you don't have to be warm and contented at that point. You just need to be on his side or in the concentration camp.
And if you disagree with the establishment, there's certainly ways of addressing that. Well, Kevin, it's Harold James's simple reminder, and he says this in his article, that massaging the truth is eternally appealing to modern governments. So whether it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Kevin, you know, we can joke about the Bureau of Truth, or, you know, something that's very sort of 1984-esque in terms of the numbers that we get and what we're to believe about the state of our union. But Kevin, frankly, this is where misrepresentation, this is the stuff that revolutions are made of.
Right.
And this is where we begin to see revolutions, again, whether it's domestic or international, we're beginning to see a revolution in the treasury markets. We're now looking at the most recent tick data, Kevin, the treasury flow data. 5 months in a row, foreign holders of treasuries have moved away from treasuries.
Well, you know, that brings up a good point because we were talking about controlling the press, controlling the crowd. You can do that in your own nation, but when you've got another country and they're converting a currency to another currency, such as converting the euro to the dollar or the yen to the dollar, whatever, if they're converting and they're feeling directly the true inflation rate by the devaluation of the buying power of that currency, they're not going to want to buy our treasuries. And so what you're saying is for the last 5 months, foreign holding of treasuries is declining, not increasing.
Right. And there's two components to that, Kevin, that are particularly important. One is the central bank liquidations and the other is the private party purchases.
Mm-hmm.
Central bank liquidations have been consistent. 5 months running, central bankers are determining the U.S. dollar they want less and less exposure to. And that includes the Chinese central bank. So, Kevin, we do have funding issues in that regard. On the other hand, we do have euro weakness at present, and you've seen private parties, individual investors coming into the U.S. Treasury market, I think in anticipation of an unwind in the banking sector in Europe, and Kevin, perhaps a liquidity event like we had in 2008. So what do they want? They want treasuries. So a bit of a divergence between private party purchases and central bank liquidations. The trend is very interesting 5 months running from central banks.
Well, and let's face it, David, we've talked over the last few months about trends, but we haven't had a 2008 kind of cusp event occur, or like the 2001 September attack. We feel like we're coming up to something, but it hasn't happened yet. Okay. But we're starting to see the criticism for those who are guarding against it. So when oil goes up or gold goes up, it's being blamed on speculators.
How about this? Try this on for size. Let's blame Bill Gross for causing a decline in the treasury market because he's no longer an owner of treasuries.
He said that just a few weeks ago.
Now, the question is, should we actually blame him? The answer, I would say, is emphatically no. He's not responsible for a decline in treasuries. He's not responsible for the overspending that government has done and had as sort of their MO for 40 years or longer.
David, if he was a true gentleman, he would stay where the game is.
He would respect the gentleman's agreement,
which is
don't cause panic, absorb a few losses here and there, but just move forward. Kevin, what he's looking at is the same thing that our foreign central bank creditors are looking at. If truly, again, let's go back to that original Bureau of Labor Statistics methodology, which counted inflation in 1980 at 10.7%. Today's inflation at 10.7%. A paltry 4% return on a long bond with inflation of 10%.
That's a 6% loss, even for simple math.
But the thing is this. On your 4% rate of return, you still pay taxes before you get robbed blind by inflation.
Okay, so it's a 7% loss. It's an 8%, but it's a loss.
And so Gross is saying to himself, this is absurd.
Right.
This is absurd. Someone's going to realize that this is absurd, and there is going to be a rout in the bond market because this is not sustainable. We're talking about a negative real rate of return of between 5 and 7%. That is not sustainable in the investment market. The only people who sign up for a voluntary gift of 5 to 7% to the marketplace are idiots. And that is the kind of investor who's moving into treasuries today, according to Bill Gross. The question is, Kevin, will he be blamed because other people take losses in the treasury market? And he was telling the truth. We've got this strange social construct, Kevin, where if someone wins and I lose, I've got to find someone to blame. It wasn't an error in my judgment.
You've got to find a scapegoat.
It was them that did it to me.
Right, which, if you think about it, there are people right now who see this coming, who will own gold at the time, who will own silver. They'll own maybe oil. They'll be called speculators. They'll be called dirty speculators ruining the market. And really, right now, people, we're already hearing this from the press. You talked about controlled press. But David, when people's families can't afford to eat because of inflation, and somebody down the block hedged ahead of time and is doing just fine,
you're going to catch the blame.
There you go.
So, Kevin, I think that's an interesting thing for investors to be aware of, a changing social dynamic in the investment markets. It's something that we talked about a little bit in Friday's comments, our weekly wrap-up comments on the wealth management website. It's not me, it's you, was the title of the thing, Kevin, because frankly, it is speculators who are being blamed in many regards for changes in the commodities markets. Kevin, it's not me and it's not you being branded as speculators, not actually speculators, but being branded as such, that are causing the upset. It is the fiscal and monetary policies implemented by Washington and every other power center around the world. And that is what investors are going to have to come to terms with. Kevin, as we mentioned earlier, we're seeking to understand the trends that are in place and the potential transitions ahead. This is what we're trying to do on the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. We are not responsible for the trends. We're simply following them.
Right.
And as I mentioned in Friday's comments, it's like flying a kite. You can't be blamed for the wind, and it's foolishness to take credit for it if you're just holding onto the string. This is going to be a wild ride as the wind picks up. I'm not responsible for it, but I am glad to participate in the ride.
Well, I guess we're just telling our people to just go fly a kite. If it's windy, go fly a kite. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We can be found at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Or you can call us and talk to us live at 800-525-9556.
The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.